This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For 27 years now, the editors of Popular Science have identified products and technologies designed to change our world in sometimes practical and sometimes profound ways. Here to tell us about just a few of the 100 items from the Best of What's New issue for 2014 is Jennifer Bogo, executive editor of Popular Science. Jennifer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start with some of the biggies. The Grand Award winner and Innovation of the Year, Newest Technologies Air Carbon. Now, what is this and why is it at the top of the list?
This is actually a plastic, which might make it kind of counterintuitive for an Innovation of the Year. But what we found particularly interesting about it was that typically plastic is made by breaking down hydrocarbons, typically oil or gas. New Light Technologies actually found a way to combine methane emissions with air to create plastic. So instead of emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere during the production of the plastic, you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and locking it up in plastic. So this is a plastic that actually costs less than regular plastic to make, and so is a potential market-driven solution to global warming.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that you find that something that's energy efficient is much less to produce.
Exactly. It's actually, we produce 660 billion pounds of plastic a year. It's a staggering amount. And so if you're able to use this plastic as sort of a giant conveyor belt to take carbon out of the atmosphere, that could be a really powerful tool.
Well, among your other Grand Award winners, some are familiar. The F-150 pickup truck. Now, this, of course, is the vehicle of choice for country songs for decades now. And duct tape. But invisible duct tape, why not until now have we had invisible duct tape?
Duct tape actually is made with a very standard formula. It's got this sort of cloth mesh in the middle of the adhesive. It's one of those things that no one ever really reinvented over the years. We're fascinated by products like this, normal, everyday products that you think are sort of like the best version of themselves. And this is actually a completely clear duct tape that has the same properties. It doesn't age and get yellow with the sun. And so it can be used, and it's waterproof, so it can be used to repair holes in tents or to cover a shattered iPhone screen so that you're not getting splinters in your thumbs. It's really just taking a regular everyday product and making it even better.
There are several different categories in your Best of What's New issue, but I'm going to focus on some green technology because there are some really interesting innovations in the built environment, especially a building in Australia, in Sydney, Australia, basically covered by a hydroponic garden and mirrors to deflect the sun. And in Toronto, a park that recycles rainwater. Tell us about these.
Well, we're interested in how engineers and landscape architects can take buildings, which are very energy intensive. They use a lot of energy. They can actually be fairly polluting in their construction and make them more sustainable. So in the case of the building in Australia, it actually uses heliostats, which are essentially giant mirrors, to reflect sunlight away from the building where it could heat it up and onto what's essentially a sort of a green, like a curtain wall of green plants. So the entire building is much more energy efficient than conventional buildings of the same size. And we really liked the park in Toronto because it was built on an industrial riverfront site, and the landscape architects figured out how to recycle every drop of water hitting that park in the form of rainwater several times. So instead of just hitting the ground and rolling off and creating a stormwater problem, it actually absorbs the water, reuses it, treats it, reuses it for playground features, They built a constructed wetland, so they actually created habitat for wildlife and just a much more pleasant place for people. It was a great use of that space.
I'm going to talk about a technology that we really could have used here a couple of weeks ago in New Hampshire around Thanksgiving when everybody lost their power. A non-diesel generator. How does this work?
The Ecos Power Cube is actually a shipping container size. So it would be a little bit big perhaps for a traditional house. But it can be shipped easily to places where you need emergency power. And it actually unfolds in just a couple of minutes. These solar panels slide out of it. It has a water treatment system, so it can clean water. It can provide telecommunications for up to 30 miles. So it's actually ideal for potential military uses and disaster zones where you need to ship a power source there that's clean and takes up a very small footprint and is very effective in a short period of time.
So this would be used for greater disasters than just losing energy in your home.
Yes, although, you know, it could easily power a neighborhood probably, so it's not out of the question.
Jennifer, what is the likelihood that these technologies do trickle down to us on the ground, you know, land at a Home Depot or a Lowe's or, you know, an office supply store?
Well, quite a few of them are. The suite of things that we look at every year are categories from aerospace. So one thing we awarded was SpaceX's Dragon version 2 capsule, which will be one of the first crafts to actually carry astronauts to the International Space Station, all the way to things like the Ford F-150 and the invisible duct tape. There are things like the 9450 smart sensor basketball, which is a basketball that has sensors on the inside that can measure your ball handling skills and potentially make your game better. So a number of these products are things that you'll see. Some of them are things that they typically will raise the bar for everybody else in their category for a period of time. How profound an impact they're going to make still remains to be seen, but we're choosing them because we think they have great potential.
Well, one that would definitely have market appeal is the Black Phone. This is landed in your gadgets category. What does the Black Phone do?
The Black Phone is actually a hyper secure consumer smartphone. Security has really been in the news a lot lately. People are very concerned about their communications and who could be listening in. And this is a smartphone that runs on a custom Android operating system. It can encrypt your calls and texts. It has anonymous search and private browsing capabilities and secure cloud storage. So it actually comes loaded with these secure apps ahead of time. So it actually makes security very simple.
How much does it cost?
It is $629 with 1 year service. So you have to really care about security.
Much less expensive would be Google Cardboard. Now, what makes this a notable gadget?
Google Cardboard is one of the first forms of virtual reality headsets that we are actually going to see. We love it because we are really interested in sort of DIY things, that popular science stuff you can build yourself. Google Cardboard is about $25 worth of cardboard and other materials that can be folded into a headset that uses your smartphone as sort of the brains of this virtual reality experience. But we're going to start to see a lot of other virtual reality headsets on the market very soon. So this is a very exciting space for consumers. There are a lot of things in development. This is one that anyone can create themselves for just a few bucks, but we're going to start seeing some very fancy, very powerful virtual reality headsets very soon.
I want to move on to the health category because popular science declares that the bionic revolution has really begun, starting with the bionic arm made by DECA. This is founded by New Hampshire's own Dean Kamen. Now, how big of an innovation is this?
We think this is really cool. This is a prosthetic arm that is so dexterous that its users can actually manipulate chopsticks and lock and unlock doors. That's pretty unprecedented for a prosthetic. It enables you to make, it picks up muscle signals that are headed towards your arm and converts them into movements for your wrist and your fingers. And so you can make multiple movements at once. It was approved by the FDA in May. It's the first truly bionic arm on the market. And as you noted, we're starting to see more things entering this kind of like bionic space for consumers. We actually recently had an exoskeleton in the office last week. Someone was walking around with it, demonstrating how it worked. And that was, it's the first exoskeleton that's been approved for therapeutic uses at home for people who are paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to see these things in our everyday lives.
Is that like the exoskeleton that was used at the World Cup opening ceremony?
That one was a little bit different in that it actually picked up, if I'm remembering correctly, it picked up brain signals and translated those into a kick. This is the spirit of it. It's the same. It's a supportive exoskeleton. You use sort of like crutches, but it supports your weight and actually makes movement much more fluid and easy. It enables people to stand and walk if they're fully paralyzed, which is just incredible.
Well, also in the health category is the walking egg lab. Now, this is a sort of DIY application, low-cost fertility treatment. What's the idea? And does it work?
This is pretty incredible. IVF is incredibly expensive, the fertility treatment, and a lot of it is just creating the conditions that can support an embryo outside of the human womb. And the walking egg lab is made by a nonprofit. It's essentially a cooler that contains citric acid and bicarbonate that creates the right temperature and the right pH for preserving an embryo until it's time for implantation. So it cuts the cost of IVF by 5 to 10. It's been tested in Belgium, I believe, successfully. There have been a number of babies born using the technology, and it's about to start trials in England and South Africa.
Just amazing. I'm wondering, over the past 27 years, you know, this has been going on since 1987. Do you all, as an editorial staff, ever go back over the winners and see if they really did make a big difference?
We do. We actually enjoy sort of going back over the years. One thing that we looked at this year was what some of those early choices were, and we noted that we had awarded the first DSLR camera, which at the time it was something like $20,000 and the size of a shoebox. So clearly, I mean, we picked that as something that was going to evolve into a technology that we'd use frequently, and it certainly did and got a lot better and a lot cheaper. So we like to catch things early.
Any others come to mind as, you know, particularly successful or great picks on your part, or maybe others that did not prove so life-changing?
Actually, another one that we chose early was the Toyota Prius before it even reached the United States. And clearly, we've seen a lot of disruption in the automotive market, and there are a lot more hybrid electric cars on the market. There are now fully electric cars on the market. And so that's one that's really proved to be the start of a trend.
Well, Jennifer Bogo, thank you very much for giving us a little glimpse of the technologies we may all find much more common in the next couple of years.
Thank you.
Jennifer Bogo is executive editor at Popular Science. The magazine's Best of What's New issue is now out, and you can see all of the innovations online at wordofmouthradio.org. When it comes to rapid innovation, sometimes all it takes is a single event to spark it. For video arcades in the late 1970s, that event was the release of Space Invaders. Andrew Bales investigates.
Since the first simple arcade games were developed in the late 60s, the video arcade has fought a war of innovation and marketing with home gaming. What's called the Golden Age of arcades was sparked by the 1978 release of Space Invaders. The game was so successful, in fact, that it brought about a shortage of 100 yen coins used in the Japanese machines. In the following years, arcades were dominated by single-player games like Pac-Man and other missions of skill, whether it was navigating the upward climb of Donkey Kong or scuttling across a busy road in Frogger. The arcade's next trick was pitting players not against a digital enemy, but against the friends they came to the arcade with. The widening consoles accommodated two-player games, like Double Dragon and the 90s releases of Street Fighter II and Mortal Kombat. Meanwhile, companies like Atari and Nintendo released numerous titles for home entertainment. Today's arcades are a bit different, primarily filled with redemption and amusement games, like Dance Dance Revolution. Home gaming has shifted as well, the majority of consoles geared towards online interaction. But the enthusiasm for the original arcade atmosphere can still be found in dive locations across major cities. Inside, the first generation of arcade goers, now all grown up and stocked with their own money that they didn't have to beg their parents for, furiously tap away at buttons and wiggle joysticks, settling scores one quarter at a time. For KMEW, I'm Andrew Bales.
We're talking about innovation today, and we're going to continue with the latest in wearable technology, the Halo. It's a battery-powered headband that can boost cognition and mood. Time to put on your brain stimulator when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If wristwatches that can answer phone calls aren't forward-thinking enough for you, consider the next wave in wearable technology. Battery-powered headbands that improve brain function. So-called neuromodulation devices rely on a small current of electricity to tweak a user's cognition and mood. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports on an industry poised to leap into the mainstream.
Nobody knows what the Halo neuroscience machine will look like. The company to date is only speaking in broad terms.
We want to build a product that's a wearable, that's ridiculously simple and easy to use.
This is Daniel Chow, founder and CEO of the San Francisco-based startup.
We also want it to be aesthetically pleasing and not scary to look at or to wear.
With the catchphrase "Be Electric," Halo plans to launch its device in 2015. It relies on something called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS. If you're picturing shock therapy, dial those expectations way back. Roy Hamilton is a neurology professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
The current we apply is very small, 1 to 2 milliamperes. Think of it as being on the same order as the current you get out of a 9-volt battery.
Hamilton researches how TDCS can be used to restore function in people who have suffered strokes and other brain injuries. It works by placing 2 electrodes, one positive, the other negative, onto various parts of the scalp.
And what happens is that this current passing through the brain, it's not enough current, it's insufficient to actually cause brain cells to fire at that time. But it is powerful enough to make very, very small changes in the likelihood that neurons are going to fire over a given period of time.
The theory is if you take that small change and multiply it by the billions of neurons in the brain, that adds up to an effect that can be measured. Studies have shown mixed results, but TDCS has helped some people with conditions including depression, anxiety, and chronic pain. In otherwise healthy brains, there's also interest in its potential to improve memory, learning, math skills, even visual sharpness. Put on the thinking cap for a 20-minute session, and some people say the world becomes clearer. The long-term effects, though, are still somewhat muddy.
It is oversimplified to think about cognition in the brain as some simple switch that you can turn on or off or turn up or down by adding electricity to the brain. Right? Brains are complex systems of connections modulated by connections modulated by connections. And so it isn't necessarily the case that if you enhance one type of performance that you're not inadvertently manipulating some other type of performance that you don't know about in some way that you don't want.
Proving that these devices are safe is going to be critical to their commercial success. Along with Halo, a venture capital-backed company called Think is also releasing an at-home TDCS unit next year. Going with the catchphrase shift/conquer, early reports suggest the product is going to target mood enhancement. There may be a setting to stimulate, another to wind down. The company brought on City College of New York professor Merome Bixon to do its clinical trial.
The short of it is that we found that both regular TDCS and the Think device were very well tolerated. There were no serious adverse events. That means nothing bad happened that anybody had to get, you know, go to the hospital or get medical treatment for.
Bixon says the device could help meet a growing demand for low-cost TDCS. There are some companies already selling units. The ventures are small scale, and the products are far from polished. One customer described his purchase as looking like a homemade bomb detonator. Other early adapters are saving themselves a few $100s by making their own stimulators.
So I have the machine perfected, well, almost perfected. I mean, it's a lot better than it was last time.
YouTube catalogs a range of at-home solutions. With $50 in Radio Shack, you can build one using instructions easily found online. While it would be nearly impossible for the FDA to regulate that sort of activity, it isn't clear yet if it is going to oversee the commercial ventures. A spokesperson says the agency doesn't comment on products that may be under review. But beyond potential regulation, the idea of cognitive enhancement brings up larger ethical questions for Hank Greeley. He's director of Stanford's program in neuroscience and society and says, imagine a world where this technology has been perfected and TDCS can be harnessed to produce really sizable gains. Then what? Do only the relatively wealthy get access? Could some people be forced to use it?
Forced by their employer, forced by the military, forced by their parents, forced by their debate coach, whatever it is. And I think those coercion issues are a big deal.
Greeley knows we are a long way off from having to tackle those issues. This is still a relatively young area of science and industry, but it's one where Daniel Chow of Halo sees huge potential, if not immediate universal acceptance.
Early on, we will have people that really embrace this technology and want to use it. But to have the masses really jump on board, I think it'll take quite some time.
However, with its intrinsic promise of a better version of you, TDCS's move from fringe to mainstream isn't so hard to imagine. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, our look into groundbreaking technologies continues in Hollywood, where digitally altered images common to magazine covers are now on the silver screen. Perfection, frame by frame, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to perfection personified by the movie star, those poreless, wrinkleless, flab-free super beings who appear giant-sized on screen. Since Hollywood's golden age, lighting, lenses, and makeup have perpetuated the illusion of flawlessness. Now in the age of high-definition film and TV, digital and cosmetic tweaks are being done for A-list celebrities frame by frame under extreme secrecy. Industry insiders call it beauty work, and it's one of Hollywood's most expensive and best-kept secrets. Josh Dickey is entertainment editor for Mashable. He found a couple of people who specialize in video retouching who were willing to talk and wrote about so-called beauty work in his article, Everyone is Altered. Josh Dickey, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So they call it beauty work. What does that cover?
Oh, my goodness. It is the extraordinarily widespread retouching of images that are no longer confined to magazine covers. It used to be that we were used to the idea that what we were seeing on the front of Cosmopolitan was a very rendered image, but actually that's happening in movies and TV now much more than we'd ever suspected.
So they have to do that frame by frame. It must cost a fortune.
It's a lot cheaper than it used to be. There's a very specific proprietary software suite called Flame that they've been using for about 10 years now. And what they can do is they can make the changes that are desired, and then those changes track across the screen as the actor moves. So they don't have to necessarily do every frame individually, although sometimes they're challenged with doing those kinds of things. But it's kind of what they used to call rotoscoping, where they'll make a change on your face, and it will follow you through the shot.
But still, you report that it's $2,500 per shot in some cases. Who gets or demands that kind of treatment?
Well, it started out a handful of years ago, just the very top elite. Just think of the most elite actors you can possibly think of. Those were the ones who were leveraging the studios to go through with this and getting them to pay for it. Nowadays, it's just kind of factored into the budget. And instead of just having a few individual shops who are doing it, you're also seeing the studios having their own proprietary beauty work done on various films, pretty much every film. It's not just confined to special effects tentpoles. We're talking rom-coms, we're talking small dramas. Pretty much anywhere you see an actor whose name you recognize, there's a very good chance that they've had some beauty work.
And how secretive is this? Does everyone just know that this is happening in Hollywood?
Well, it's funny. The reaction to my story has ranged from total shock and, you know, people feeling like the scales are falling from their eyes to, oh, I didn't realize this was a secret. But Those who didn't realize it was a secret have either been practicing it or have been aware of it because they're deep inside the industry. One of the challenges of reporting this story was getting anybody to talk about it because nobody wants to admit that, if you remember in the 90s, nobody wanted to admit they were having plastic surgery done. Now it's just sort of the norm. Mm-hmm. But nobody wanted to admit that they were having this digital retouching done because it was, in some cases, so very extensive. I mean, they literally can take 15, 20 years off of you, or they can take 15 or 20 or 50 pounds off of you. And if it's done well, you won't notice it.
Why did people talk to you? This is governed completely by non-disclosure agreements, I imagine.
It is. I have an actor who I knew and had gotten friendly with, and we went out to lunch, and this person told me all about what was going on, and I was shocked. This was a few years ago. It took me a long time to kind of crack it open and get anybody to engage with me about it. And the final break came from a gentleman who works at Method Studios. His name is Klaus Hansen. He's quoted in the story, and he was like, yeah, sure. I think it's about time for people to know about this. So once I had somebody on the record, then other voices started to trickle in.
He told you nobody looks like what you see on TV in the movies. Everybody is altered.
And it's not just people who you would necessarily assume need work. We're talking about young, up-and-coming perfect human specimens who are having stuff retouched and nipped and tucked all over the place.
Well, you did also talk to people who work at Lola Visual Effects. Wouldn't go on the record, I guess, but they did the film The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Now, this is the movie that had, I guess he was then about 40-something, Brad Pitt. He has a disease that made him age in reverse, so he starts in the film as an old man. It was a pretty convincing illusion. Is that what they are doing effectively to other movie stars in film?
Absolutely. There's a scene in Benjamin Button where he comes out into the dance studio and he looks like he's about 20, you know, 23, 24 years old. It's a shot. It's a stunning visual. I mean, it really, really worked. And that was kind of where they got the idea, like, hey, we can do this with pretty much anybody at any time. We don't have to age somebody back 20 years, we can just age them back 5 years, or we can go through and, you know, cut and paste out their crow's feet, or, you know, take the bags out from under their eyes, or remove, you know, pimples or what have you, thicken hair, whiten teeth, build muscle, anything really we could do, and nobody has to know that we're doing it. It doesn't have to be this special effect, and that sort of gave rise to this cottage industry that's pretty rampant right now in Hollywood.
But how can they do this without it looking just, you know, sort of, sometimes you see in magazine covers, you think, okay, it's impossible that that person doesn't have pores. You know, it's kind of millimeters worth of work in some cases, isn't it?
It really is, and it sort of plays against our expectations of what a movie will show versus what, say, a music video will show. So if you go back to a J-Lo music video from, you know, 5-6 years ago, you'll see that their skin tone looks like almost like it's metallurgic. You know, they're so smoothed over and they're so stylized, but we've come to expect that in music videos. If you looked that way in a movie, it would be very unusual and uncanny, and it would upset our eyes. So what they have to do is be very, very judicious about what they change and how they change it. It's an art, but it's also a science. And the science part of it is part that they've paid attention to. We age in very specific ways, and they understand how that works and incorporate that into their work.
You point out, Josh Dickey, that visual alterations are as old as Hollywood. But when did this kind of work become part of the cost of making a movie?
Well, I would say it probably started to be cooked into the budgets in the last 5 or 6 years. It's kind of hard to pinpoint. Some of the first work of this sort was done sort of on purpose. If you think about Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, when Arnold Schwarzenegger walks into a roadhouse having just time traveled with no clothes on, and he looks like Mr. Universe all over again. I suspect a lot of people at the time thought, wow, he's really kept himself in shape. But then there are photos of him on the beach, you know, a couple weeks after the movie comes out, where he looks like a totally normally aged, you know, late 40s, early 50s, wherever he was at that point. So they've been doing it for quite some time, but it was always sort of as an effect for the film, to the degree that they've been doing it just because, hey, you know, this actress just spent a weekend partying, just took a red eye back to the set and looks quite terrible and needs to be retouched, or for instance, you know, a 24-year-old A-list actress playing a 17-year-old heroine in a young adult movie is not going to look like a 17-year-old. Naturally, we have to do something about that. That kind of work is more recent.
Well, despite these candid photos that suggest that stars are just like us, you know, they go shopping, they go to Starbucks, they walk on the beach, beauty work sustains this illusion that we will never be quite as perfect as they are. But Botox and fillers used to be a celebrity secret. They're now very common. Do you think video retouching for our home videos is very far behind?
Well, it's funny. They actually, you know, Klaus wouldn't, well, he disclosed to me exactly who it was, but he has retouched home videos for very top celebrities. There was a birthday video that he cleaned up in order to, you know, probably just to preserve it for posterity. Perhaps this person someday will show this video, you know, documentary or something like that, and it will be altered.
So, Josh, do you find yourself watching films now and thinking, oh, wait, those crow's feet don't look real, or, you know, how could anybody have such washboard abs?
It's funny, I do all the time, and one of the most common things that's done is the jawline, so the neck, the skin between your chin and the top of your chest. You know, generally when you turn your head a certain way, it tends to form a line that is not perhaps totally flattering at every angle, but in movies, they always cut that line right up to the jawline. So you'll see now when you watch films that jawline always looks about as tight as it possibly can, and there's certainly a reason for that.
Yeah, it's a waddle-free zone in Hollywood.
It sure is.
Josh Dickey, entertainment editor at Mashable. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Josh wrote about beauty work, the secret Hollywood procedure that has fooled us for years. And you'll find a link to read his article, Everyone is Altered, at wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we continue, we'll discuss one of the most significant technological advances in the world of sports broadcasting, the instant replay. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout today's show, we've been talking about technological advances in science and manufacturing and art, and now sports. Tune into a pro football game any given Sunday, and you'll be dazzled by graphics and sweeping camera movements along the field and digital lines marking each down. But the biggest leap to televised football came in 1963, when a rash young CBS producer invented the instant replay. Last year, Anna Clark profiled Tony Verna for Pacific Standard Magazine. We went back to the archives for this conversation about Tony's contribution to sports history. Anna, give us a little context here of the game and the play that was first instantly replayed thanks to Tony Verna, who you write about. Pretty significant time, pretty significant game. What happened?
Sure. It took place on December 7th, 1963, which, of course, as we know, was a pretty significant moment in American history. This was, you know, just a couple weeks after Kennedy's assassination, when, you know, live political news was like, you know, gluing American audiences to their televisions. And of course, soon after Kennedy's assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald had been shot on live television, and baffled audiences and news directors were in a position to, you know, have to like wait for many long minutes while stations tried to patch together a replay of the clip to just even see what had happened, because it was so confusing. So that had happened, and also just, you know, the national sadness for like that, this whole traumatic incident was the shadow hanging over this huge rivalry football game that had been postponed and was now being played on December 7th. So Army and Navy were taking the field with a fair amount of emotion and excitement about the game as well. There's 100,000 people at the there in Merchant Stadium. There was a lot of people watching at home. It turned out to be a very exciting game. You know, Navy was one of the best teams in the nation. They were going to go on and play for the national championship. They were led by quarterback Roger Staubach, who just won the Heisman Trophy. And Tony Verna was spending this broadcast trying to get a great instant replay clip of Staubach, the hero of the game, one of the heroes of the season. And it kept fumbling. It kept not quite working with the machines, the technology, other issues. And it wasn't until the fourth quarter when Army scored a touchdown that I was able to finally air the instant replay clip.
Now, this is before the advent of digital technology. Was he cutting tape back there with a razor blade?
Oh, my goodness. It was extremely complicated. There's a reason it had never been done before he tried it. At the time, people had experimented with replay before, but usually because of the big machines you had to use, because of the actual physical film you were working with, the soonest you could show a replayed clip was maybe 15 minutes or so after the game.
So how'd Tony do it?
Well, he had to be sneaky. He did not have the permission to do this. The way he tells it to me, that the network would have wanted to do a lot more research on the how to do instant replay, the value of it, so on. They would have wanted to, as he says, have it be an idea that came out of the higher-ups at the company rather than him, a production guy. So what he did is he had to basically heist some of the best equipment that the network had, which would have been kept in Grand Central Station. He hauled it to the game in Philadelphia, and he spent the entire game trying to figure out how to get the clip to work. They had the camera trained on Roger Staubach, but every time they tried to get it together, there was some clip from the what had been previously on the film, because they reused film frequently to save space and money and so on. This high quality film that they were using had I Love Lucy and some soap commercials on it. Right? So every time they try to do a clip, they're like, all right, we got it. And they play it back to just make sure before they air it. And there would be, you know, Lucille Ball, like, you know, like just suddenly
doing
showing
something
up,
wacky.
Right? You know, just wouldn't make no sense. So it didn't work until the fourth quarter before he was able to pull it off once, but it made a powerful impression.
So I Love Lucy aside, how did people and players react at the time seeing this instant replay?
It was very confusing because nobody knew that this was something to even expect. So the announcers, you know, narrating the game weren't quite sure how to narrate it, and viewers at home weren't quite sure what to make of it either. So if you're watching this game at home, you see Army score, and maybe you're an Army fan, you're very excited about it. It's terrific. And then a second later, you see Army score once again. And then you're like, oh my God, did they just take the lead? And it got even more confusing when Army went for a 2-point conversion and again ran into the end zone. And so a lot of people at home were very confused about what was going on, even though the announcers were trying to help people out by assuring them Army did not score again. This is not live. This is a replay.
Well, you just mentioned people watching at home. We've become used to instant replay. How has it changed the way that we watch and even play sports?
Profoundly. I mean, it's become embedded in the game, you know. I mean, it's instant replay isn't just like something that's a trick of television for the advantage of those of us watching at home. It's literally changed the rules with replay reviews, with our expectation for what counts as fair and what doesn't. You know, I think it's brought a level of precision to our expectations for what we see that would have been unfathomable years ago. You know, sports fans 50 years ago weren't in a position to be like constantly replaying a clip to see if it was actually holding or not. You know, it was enough to generally get the gist, you know, and other sports have to a certain point or another ultimately come to embrace it as well. Even baseball, which is notorious for never, ever changing its rules. Mm-hmm. It's changed its rules 3 times since the dead ball era. And one of them is to bring in replay review by managers starting the season.
Well, what do you think referees think now? They have a whole different standard that they are judged by.
Right. It's a very different game for officials as well. And college football started bringing in instant replay in about 10 years ago. And officials at the time, from those I was talking to, were very wary. You know, like they had a job to do. Most of them really do want to be as fair as possible. They love the game. They just, you know, just care about, you know, making sure it's a good experience for the players and the fans and so on. And they're really nervous about bringing in this other element. It could be very embarrassing to them. Some of them were worried about other officials on their crew maybe slacking off because they didn't have to try as hard to get it right because the camera could just catch it. There's a lot of nervousness about it. But once, you know, it slowly started getting integrated in the game, most officials ended up really loving it, embracing it, because they found out that replay review affirmed that they were right most of the time. You know, like officials actually do a very good job. And, and on the occasion when they do screw it up, they now have the opportunity to have that corrected, which most of them are actually glad for. They don't want to be like 2 weeks later, you know, like being haunted by some influential missed call, right?
Tony joked to you that his tombstone will say, son of Italian immigrants invented instant replay. But he isn't really a household name. Do you think the public has given Tony enough respect for his contribution to the game?
I think that it's true that like almost nobody does know his name. And those who do tend to be very much insiders, you know. And I do think he deserves credit for being able to put this together. Because, again, it was not easy. I mean, nowadays, you know, we have TiVo and all high definition technology, and it's much, much quicker. At the time, it really was a complicated feat to pull together, and he did it because he simply wanted to have a better broadcast. You know, he had a bit of a visionary in him for like why the broadcast of sports was really mattered, and that it could grow beyond what it was in 1963. And as we know, televised sports is huge, huge today. Had a huge impact on the growth of sports, especially football. And I feel like it took people taking risks like he did to make that so.
Anna Clark, freelance writer and contributor to Pacific Standard. Now you've made all of us insiders. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Anna wrote about Tony Verna and the invention of instant replay. And you can read that article. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Instant replay is a regular feature for the most popular and lucrative sports, not so much for lower-stakes competitive sports. And as we've seen, just about anything can be turned into a competition. Take competitive coffee making. In 2013, producer Alex Lewis followed a man who'd set his hopes on becoming the best barista in the country.
For many people, the criteria for a good cup of coffee can simply be that it's warm and potent. But for Brian Galletly, it's much more than that.
Really great coffee. It's totally different than your normal experience with coffee. It's not, you know, you're not thinking about like ashiness and like overwhelming bitter flavors. And when you get like really good coffee and it's brewed well, it's like sweet, it's bright, it's like it's got a lot of neat aromatics.
Yeah. Looks like the initial flow's a little.
Galletly found his calling almost immediately upon graduating from the University of Pennsylvania in 2010. He attended a few cuppings, wine tastings for specialty coffee, and was captivated by the role of the barista.
It was just a world opening up. I realized that, you know, the barista does have an important job for the coffee. Like, you can start with great coffee, and if you don't brew it well, it's not going to be great.
This year, Galletly was a finalist in the Northeast Regional Competition, which qualified him for the U.S. Barista Championship. He's the first Philly-based barista to ever make it that far, but it's arguably the last line of work he should be in.
It came to a head where I was working and I just started feeling like I was losing feelings in my fingers, and I was like, I'm a little worried right now. And then I sat down, and then it was just like I knew something was wrong, and then like a couple seconds later I like fainted.
After fainting a second time, Galletly sought help, ending up at a cardiologist. He doesn't have a formal diagnosis, but the doctors say he should not drink any caffeine. So now when he works at Ultimo Coffee in South Philly, or when he's competing, Galletly tastes and spits out his work. The championship took place in the massive Boston Convention Center. Baristas had 15 minutes to brew 4 espressos, 4 cappuccinos, and 4 specialty drinks.
And those finals will battle it out for the coveted title, 2013 United States Barista Champion.
While they say the competition is about who can make the best coffee, it also seems to be about who puts on the best show.
So I'm looking over my lines. I have my little notebook here with my script. I may not go...
And cool evening temperatures. All this coffee fruit to ripen slowly, which results in a high influx of sweetness, of sugars, and amino acids.
His performance is a little nervous, and he finishes a few seconds over time.
I'm just glad that's over. I have no idea how this is going to turn out.
All the competitors for round one of the 2013 USBC, please come up here as well and stand behind us in the pit.
No particular order, the first of the 12. Mr. Josh Taves, Dogwood Coffee.
Galletly's name is not called. He's out. Head judge Dan Streetman gives him advice for next time.
Keep at it. I mean, barista competition
very much can be an any given Sunday kind of thing. I think as a competitor, there are so many things that are outside of your control that lend to your success to become a champion, that really the thing that you only thing you can focus on is your performance and how you did.
It's not long before Galletly is back home slinging espressos at Ultimo Coffee in South Philly.
I have a hard time picturing myself not making it all the time and like giving, like serving it to people.
Galletly says he'll definitely be pursuing the championship next year.
But until then, he's content making what he hopes his Philly customers think are perfect cups of coffee.
Producer Alex Lewis's profile of Philadelphia barista Brian Galletty and his bid to win the 2013 National Barista Championships. You can learn more about competitive coffee making at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Earlier in the show, we spoke with the executive editor of Popular Science magazine about some of the greatest innovations of 2014, from clear duct tape to the black phone. You'll find the entire list. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback and share your thoughts for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most useful ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.